Committee. We're sorry that we're getting a later start than posted. Our floor session ran long today, and I suspect that's going to be the case here for the next while, so we'll just have to try to be flexible if you can with us. We're going to work through the agenda today, starting at the top. Once again, we have come to find out that a bill that we took action on needs to go to the Ways and Means Committee before it goes to the floor. So I'm going to move that the rules be suspended for the purpose of reconsidering the vote on House Bill 3177. Is there any objection to my motion? Hearing none, the rules are suspended. And I move that we reconsider the vote by which we passed House Bill 3177 to the floor with a do pass recommendation. Apparently, as I said, it has a Ways and Means fiscal impact that will require the bill to go to the Ways and Means Committee, and that's what we will do. So that's the reason for my motion for the reconsideration. Is there any objection to that motion? Hearing none, so ordered. And now I move that House Bill 3177 be sent to the floor with a do pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion on that motion? Those who are in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries, and 3177 now goes to the Ways and Means Committee. I don't know who we had assigned to carry that bill originally.
Anderson.
But who was that?
Anderson.
Who was Representative Anderson?
Yes.
Oh, well, we just got you off some work, Representative Anderson.
He really wanted to carry this one because it actually says Senator on the summary sheet.
Oh, I called him Senator Anderson, too?
I'll take it.
Sorry.
It's here to be given.
Back to a Representative.
Unfortunately, that bill had a Ways and Means fiscal impact, and we're going to send it to the Ways and Means Committee. So with that, we'll now move on to House Bill 2592. I'll open a public hearing on that bill and ask Carl Myers, and Paul indicated that he had another bill up in another committee, so you may just need to put on the record their position. And then,
do that.
Thank you
very much, Mr. Chair. For your record, Carl Myers, on behalf of the Oregon Justice Peace Association, I'm here with Judge Jad Lemhouse, who will explain. You've got two bills in front of you from the association. The first one, 2592. I will indicate also for your record, I spoke with Paul Snyder of Associated Oregon Counties. Associated Oregon Counties is in support of both JP bills that you'll see today. I'll put on the record for both hearings that support from the Associated Oregon Counties. With that, I would turn the presentation of 2592 over to the Honorable Jad Lemhouse.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm Judge Jad Lemhouse, Justice of the Peace, Linn County District, Justice Court District Number 4, and also I serve as municipal judge for the cities of Brownsville, Halsey, and Harrisburg. The purpose of House Bill 2592 is to allow justice courts to refer judgments in criminal actions to the Department of Revenue for collection. So we feel that the Department of Revenue can greatly assist the justice courts in the collection of unpaid judgments, just as it does the circuit courts. And I point out that since the statehood, justice courts have been considered state courts, and although we're often forgotten or neglected, nonetheless, we would like to be able to use the same types of services provided by the Department of Revenue that the other state courts, primarily the circuit courts, do. The Justice of the Peace Association asked me to do a survey that indicates that most of the justice courts in the state would use the services of the Department of Revenue were those services to be available for collection purposes. The second page of the document that I submitted with respect to House Bill 2592 contains a listing of those courts, whether the first column is the court, the second column is whether or not they would use Department of Revenue collections, the third column is the number of referrals that would initially be made by the court to the Department of Revenue, and then the fourth column is the monthly referrals that each court would anticipate to sending to the Department of Revenue. I've previously made contact with the Department of Revenue and provided most of this information to the Department of Revenue, other agency collections unit, and so I'm assuming that the Department of Revenue is aware of this and would probably likely have a very possibly have somebody here to testify if they have any concerns with the bill. I'm aware of no concerns that have been raised at this point by the Department of Revenue.
Are there questions for Judge Limhouse? Carl? Do you have anything to add?
Mr. Chair, I just need to remind the committee that part of the revenue that would be collected would go to the state through the CFAA criminal fines and assessment account, the unitary assessment that is part of the collections. So this is not going to not only help the counties in their collection efforts, but will also increase revenue, hopefully, to the state of Oregon through that account. That's all I have, Mr. Chair. I'm happy to try to respond to any questions.
Okay. Judge Limhouse?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, just to amplify Judge Meyer's remarks, the typical justice courts pay somewhere between 30% and 60% of total court revenue to the criminal fine assessment account on an annual basis. And for that reason, you'll notice on the first page of the testimony that's been submitted, you'll see that the average justice of the peace pays almost about the same amount of money, just a little bit less, to the criminal fine assessment account as does the average circuit court judge. So on a per-judge basis, the amount of revenue that goes to the state of Oregon from justice courts is fairly significant.
Okay. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Marquis.
Mr. Chair, members of the Judiciary Committee, I'm Jim Marquis, today representing the Oregon Collectors Association, and with all due respect to the proponents of the bill, I'm here to respectfully oppose the bill in its present form. The Oregon Department of Revenue runs an other agency program in which they collect debts for other state agencies and have for some time. We have no problem with that. This is a fairly significant change in public policy, we believe, for the state of Oregon, in that justice courts are part of local government, and we would be having the Department of Revenue now collect on behalf of a local government entity. If that's the public policy that we want to pursue, then probably we ought to have a discussion about the Department of Revenue collecting for local government generally. And I think one could raise the question, if we're going to do that for justice courts, should we do it for municipal courts? If we're going to do it for municipal courts, should we do it for cities? If we're going to do it for cities, should we do it for counties, et cetera? That's our concern. I think that the Department of Revenue actually runs two programs for state agencies, and one of those programs is a program whereby a state agency simply submits a list of its debtors, and the Department of Revenue runs that against tax refunds that are due to that individual. So it's just simply a tax offset program. And then the second program that they run is where a state agency actually does a full assignment of the account to the department, and they have people employed there that do full-blown collections on that debt. This bill, of course, would allow the full assignment. If this bill were limited just to the tax offset, I think that we wouldn't have a problem necessarily with that. But I do think that where you have the Department of Revenue employing people doing full-blown collections, they are, in essence, in competition with my clients who currently do these collections for local governments of all kinds. And so that's our concern. Be happy to answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Marquis? Okay, thank you, Jim. Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2592? Okay, hearing none, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2592. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2594. And again, Carl Myers, Judge Lemhouse, and Paul Snyder, if you're here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, for the record, Carl Myers on behalf of the Oregon Justice of the Peace Association. The association supports House Bill 2594, and again, I brought with me Judge Jad Lemhouse to speak on the bill and the need for its passage.
Judge Lemhouse, welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Judge Jad Lemhouse, the Justice of the Peace for Linn County Justice of the Court District Number 4, and I'm also serve as Municipal Judge for the cities of Halsey, Brownsville, and Harrisburg. I have a single-page explanation for House Bill 2594, and very simply what it is intended to do is to bring some unity to where there's presently some conflict and confusion about the reporting dates for the obligations of payment obligations that the justice courts and municipal courts have. And if you see the table that's in the lower half of the page, I give you an example of how that confusion exists. There are about five different statutes that purport to regulate when the payments from justice courts are to be made to various public agencies. And what we would like to do is to make a single date, the last date of the month following in which the obligation has been paid or collected. If you look at the table, this illustrates how a typical $100 judgment on a traffic citation issued by an Oregon State Police trooper would be divided and paid in a justice court. You'll notice that the fine in this case would be $48, and that's split between the State of Oregon Criminal Fine Assessment Account and the County Treasury. There's a $35 unitary assessment that is paid to the Criminal Fine Assessment Account. There's a county assessment that is paid to the County Treasurer that's used for adult and juvenile corrections, 60% and 40% for the court security or court facilities security account. There's also $1 collected for the law enforcement medical liability account, which is also paid to the State of Oregon. And finally, there's a $5 court cost that is paid to the county general fund as well. So if you look over at the column that lists the due date for this judgment, you'll see that there are a number of different due dates that this judgment, the money would be required to be reported on. And sometimes they're in conflict. For example, the money's paid to the county treasurer for the portion of the fine. Now, there are two statutes that purport to regulate that. One is in Chapter 153, and the other one is in Chapter 156. 153 deals with the distribution of traffic fines generally. Chapter 156 deals with the distribution of monies from the Justice of the Peace specifically. So which statute does the court follow? The one that says that that's to be paid by the 20th day of each month or by the 30th day of the month following the month in which the debt was collected. The $24 or the portion of the fine that would be paid to the State of Oregon is paid by the 20th of the month. As you go down the list, you'll see that there are a number of different conflicting and dissimilar dates for which these obligations are to be paid. What we would like to do is have a single standard date so our clerk could just make a single distribution by a particular date and not have to worry about accounting over a several months period for various obligations. this problem came to my attention a couple of years ago when the Linn County auditors were auditing my court, and they found that we weren't making payments on these various dates to these several different agencies, and I tried to explain to the auditors how difficult it was to try to do all these things on different dates, and so that I simply had entered an order that we're going to have a date certain by which all these obligations are going to be paid, and that's what the clerks were doing, was following the order that I had entered. That didn't make the auditors very comfortable. And so what I would like to do is make those auditors a lot more comfortable than they presently are if we can. And in order to do that, we need to have a single uniform date for all these various obligations that the justice courts are supposed to be satisfying. One other thing that this chart does do is it also illustrates the substantial amounts of money the justice courts pay to the State of Oregon on judgments that are entered in justice courts. As you've noticed that in this particular example, I believe it's about 50... No, it's... more than half of the judgment is paid to the state, and less than half actually goes to the county treasurer. And so the state definitely has an interest in the justice courts. We are, after all, state courts.
and we appreciate the contributions that you make, especially at this current
time.
At least at this current time, yeah, or at least it says. Questions for Judge Lemhouse? Paul?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we support House Bill 2594. We believe it's good government because it eliminates confusion and creates efficiency.
Okay. The one question that I had, obviously, is that, I mean, it doesn't sound like you're doing it now, so it may not make or have much impact. Obviously, some of these dates would have required distribution to certain funds, whether they be county or, in some cases, state funds, earlier than the date that we're setting by the bill. While individually it probably doesn't amount to very much money, over time, collectively, I could imagine that slowing down those transfers by 10 days or 15 days could, over time, make a difference with respect to interest earnings and that kind of thing. Have you had any feedback from anybody on that?
I haven't had any specific feedback. The the amount of money, of course, under present interest rates, even assuming that there was something that they could be attributed as interest, it would not be very significant. The reason I chose the date the last day of the month following the month in which is collected is because that's consistent with ORS 137.295, which basically sets forth the obligations that are payable to the state of Oregon on basically all offenses. And so what I tried to do was to make it consistent throughout so that our state obligations and our county obligations are all come due on the same date.
Right.
And that date is the last day of each month.
From the state perspective, the only one that it looks like it's elongating is the fine amount, the $24 under your example for the CFAA, whereas the unitary assessment amount stays the same.
That's correct.
And then some of the county monies, obviously, and if the counties are supportive of it, it seems like you guys would have thought about that and made a decision. So, okay, Representative Shetterly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question. I know that this is drafted just the way Judge Lemhouse put it in. The question I had looking at it today, the emergency clause, does that create a problem for administration in courts? If this is signed into law and becomes effective immediately, are there accounting practices that need to be changed over that they might need the 91st day after sign to die or something like that, just administratively to make that change?
You know, I think we probably wouldn't need to have the emergency clause. The point that you raise, I think, is a good, excuse me, Mr. Chairman, Representative Shetterly, I agree that probably the emergency clause is not necessary in this particular bill, and that having a little bit of lead time would be probably a good idea. What we would probably like to do, though, is if at all possible, if it could be passed in sufficient time so that we could begin the new fiscal year on July 1, then that might be an appropriate effective date if the bill could somehow be passed rapidly.
Well, we could try to target a July 1 effective date. I don't know how effective that would be, because once we do what we're going to do with the bill, it's sort of out of our control.
Chair, actually, with that in mind, maybe what we could do, and just to move this thing along, move it out as is, and when it gets to the Senate, you'll have a sense of how fast it's moving through the Senate and maybe be able to target an effective date better than we could do here. Mm-hmm. And then we just concur in that amendment, and you're on your way.
Mr. Chair, Representative Shetterly, I would see to that. I think that's a good solution to this.
To the extent that it's elongating, for the most part, period of time these monies are due, as opposed to shortening them, it doesn't seem like it would create, you know, a significant burden on current accounting systems since they're getting more time as opposed to less time in which to make these transfers. But it's a worthy point. Any other questions for this panel? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Anyone else here to discuss House Bill 2594? Brad, I don't see you guys signed up on this.
We're not signed up on it.
You guys don't have an opinion on the bill?
Chair Williams, member of the committee, for the record, my name is Brad Swank. We did a fiscal on it, but we haven't taken a position on it now.
And we haven't seen the fiscal, Brad. So you may have turned it into the fiscal office, but we don't have anything indicating that there's a fiscal associated with this bill.
Chair Williams, members of the committee, my recollection is that we didn't think that it would have an effect on us.
Okay.
We may have raised some issues down there, as I recollect, but in terms of having an effect on our courts, it doesn't change any of the dates in our courts, in my recollection.
Okay.
Anybody else on House Bill 2594? Okay, hearing none, we're going to close the public hearing. We're going to open a work session. I'm going to take Representative Shetterly's lead. I think it does make sense to move the bill along, and we can deal with the issue of whether or not to keep the emergency clause when the bill gets over to the Senate, and the proponents can work with the Senate Judiciary Committee on the timing of the implementation date. That would be my suggestion.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Then in that case, I'd move House Bill 2594 to the floor with the due pass recommendation.
Representative Shetterly moves House Bill 2594 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Are there discussion? Is there discussion? Okay. Hearing none, Ann, do you want to call the roll?
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Crummell?
Excuse. Although Representative McPherson, I would point out, sorry, Ann, to break your vote up, but you're sitting behind the tag for Representative Crummell today.
I've been misidentifying, haven't I?
Incognito.
That'll be in a hit piece.
That's all right, Ann. Keep going.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Trubowski?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 2594 will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any volunteer to carry the bill?
I'll carry it, then.
You want to carry it, Representative Shetterly? Okay. It's your bill. Okay, we are now going to move on to House Bill 3259. I'll open a public hearing, and only Mr. Landauer has signed up to testify on this bill. Do you want to come? Oh, Representative Dingfelder, are you here for this bill? We'll sign you up.
Good timing.
Yeah, I don't know how she...
Working in the hall.
Really good. Representative Dingfelder, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We're having a little challenge with making sure everyone's signed up. So is it possible to add a few people to the testimony?
Sure. You tell me who you want to add, and we'll put them on the list.
My staff is Dr. Holcomb from DHS.
Dr. Holcomb?
Yes.
Okay.
Anyone else here? Okay. Sorry, we're running a little behind here. Thank you for your understanding. Chair Williams and members of the Judiciary Committee, for the record, I am State Representative Jackie Dingfelder of House District 45, and I am the chief co-sponsor or the chief sponsor of this measure. As you well know, the proliferation of methamphetamines is a growing problem in our communities, and one of the problems associated with the drug are the labs that are used to manufacture it. Many of the chemicals and substances used in the manufacturing of meth are toxic and otherwise harmful, and they pose a real health risk to humans. I ask that you read the written testimony that I've provided, which comes from a constituent of mine who regrettably could not be here for today, and I've also provided you with a copy of the Portland Tribune article that ran last Friday, and I will refer to you the huge color copy that just ran last Friday, which highlights the problem as well. I introduced this bill because I am concerned that citizens are not receiving adequate information about the dangers associated with these meth labs. In Portland, the only notification neighbors receive is a direct posting on the lab structure, which is usually removed within 24 to 48 hours. In fact, this issue was initially brought to my attention by a constituent who learned about a neighboring meth lab from her children who had been playing on the premises. What this bill does is encourages local governments to provide notice about the site in question. The notice shall include the phone number of the Department of Human Services, the agency responsible for overseeing decontamination of these sites, and Department of Human Services website, which contains information about the dangers associated with these labs. Seems to be a constant stream of people coming in and out. I think I'll wait until the door closes. With regards to the bill, I've worked with representatives from local governments to address their concerns, and the Dash 1 amendments that I provided represent that collaborative effort. My primary concern is informing citizens, particularly when such real health risks are present. And I feel that this bill, along with the amendments, will help provide the information to citizens that they need to protect themselves and their children from the very real dangers that this site possesses, that these type of sites possess. And I have a couple people here going to talk more about the mechanics of the bill, but I will stay in case there's additional questions. And thank you, Mr. Chair, and committee members for considering this bill.
Representative Dienfelder, why don't you stay where you're at and so we can ask some additional questions.
Sure.
And then we'll ask Dr. Holcomb to come forward. And was there anyone else?
Yeah, I think Mark Landauer.
Okay.
Well.
All right, we had Mark on there. So come
might
on
as well up. Have everyone come up. I'll have a
sure.
party up here.
Dr. Holcomb?
Thank you.
When you're ready.
Chairman William and members of the committee, I'm Dr. Michael Holcomb, Environmental Toxicology Manager, Department of Human Services. Oregon Department of Human Services supports Bill 3259. It requires, of course, the State Fire Marshal as well as Department of Human Services or law enforcement agencies to give written notice to school districts or persons residing or working within 300 feet of formal drug labs. The department supports this bill because it potentially will eliminate the unintentional exposure or the unintentional exposure of people to toxic chemicals and compounds. In addition, communities that are aware of contaminated properties in their midst are in the position to place pressure on property owners to actually clean up these properties. If the aim of the bill is achieved, we can expect significant decreases in the contaminated drug lab sites. While we anticipate a slight effect on our workload, we do not anticipate any fiscal impact. Illegal drug lab properties continue to be a threat to the health of Oregonians. Law enforcement agencies and judicial system continues to have to deal with offenders. The contaminated areas can cause great danger to those living in those areas. For example, the chemicals that are present at contaminated sites include solvents, include chemicals that remain once these people are arrested. If someone wanders into this property and are exposed to these harmful chemicals, they will suffer significant effects. As you can see, the signs that we post are often taken down, and children can wander into the property as well as adults. These chemicals also harm pets. As we continue to look at these clandestine drug labs, with their potential to contaminate surrounding areas, it is very clear to us that someone has to be warned that these chemicals are present, including the neighbors, including those who could potentially be exposed. Drug labs are located in houses and in apartments and in other places, such as in cars. If we do not warn people of the fact that these labs are present, their health could be in danger. The Department of Human Services and our clandestine drug lab program gives full support to this bill. Over the past 10 years, we've had to clean up approximately 1,147 drug labs. We continue to clean up approximately 200 drug labs per year. We have the funds available to support this bill, and most certainly the initiative will help us prevent people from being harmed. If you have any further questions or concerns, I'm here to answer those questions.
Thank you, Dr. Holcomb. Why don't we go ahead and proceed with Mr. Landauer's testimony, and then we can open up for questions.
Good afternoon. Mark Landauer with the Office of Government Relations for the City of Portland. The City of Portland would support House Bill 3259 if the Dash 1 amendments were incorporated into the bill. Just by way of background, this is the only public notification that's provided to citizens when a meth lab is found in their neighborhood, as previously heard. Oftentimes, these placards are torn down within a very reasonable or very short period of time. At these places. Obviously, when that occurs, nobody is aware, except for the fact that the house may be vacant, that there is a meth lab within their neighborhood. The goal of this bill is really to try to encourage or provide a carrot to local communities to provide this type of notification to citizens within their jurisdictions. It's not a requirement. We don't believe it creates a duty for local governments to provide this notification. But for those communities that do want to provide this type of important health and safety information to their citizens, it provides a clear, explicit permission to do so. One of the other results of the bill would be that it amends ORS 93275. I've provided written testimony, which is much more detailed. But Section 4 would simply make it clear that if a property owner receives a notification about a neighboring property not fit for use, that notice would not be a material fact in a real estate or residential real estate transaction. Currently, it might... An attorney might argue that if a citizen receives notification, that's a disclosable item, even though it's not about the property that is being sold. The Real Estate Association asked that we include this clarification. We were happy, obviously, to do so, to make it clear that this is not a disclosable issue. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions. My detailed testimony is before you.
Okay, questions by the committee for the panel? Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I have a question perhaps of the Representative Dinkfelder. Being lawyers like we are, and looking at your Dash 1 amendments, the duty upon the local government then is discretionary, since the use of the word may in line 19. Is that what I understand?
That's correct.
Okay. And then I'm concerned about the language in line 22 and 24, where the notice would be given to a person. Read literally, you could serve it on one person, I think, satisfy the requirement of the Act. On the other hand, to every person might be too burdensome, but you may want to consider a household, or every household within the parameters of the amendments. Do you have any comments on those issues or questions?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, you raise an excellent point, and we actually looked at changing that to residence.
Excuse me?
We looked at changing instead of a person to residence, and so I think that there needs to be some massaging done on that, because we did catch that, and I don't know if that's an amendment we would do here or possibly over in the Senate, but that is something that we definitely need to consider. And I don't know if Mr. Landauer has any comments on that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landauer again for the record. That would certainly be an appropriate amendment. As Representative Dinkfelder mentioned, be happy to do it at the chair's pleasure, either here or in the other chamber.
Mr. Chair.
Council.
You might want to change A to any and leave person in. There's a statutory definition of person that actually came up today in the Senate Judiciary in the morning. If you put residents there, you wouldn't catch businesses, and I assume you'd also want to notify businesses. But
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, actually, we do have a little bit of concern about going towards work sites. For instance, and I know that this was a problem that occurred prior to last session, but there was a meth lab that was found in a hotel room. Let's just say this were to occur in downtown Portland. Frankly, tracking down every person or work site in a downtown area may be problematic. And that is a concern of ours. I think that we're trying to limit this really to residential areas, but of course if the committee sees fit that they want to go for work sites as well, tracking down who the owner or all the people who work in a place, it can be very difficult.
I noted by the squeaking of Representative Przanski's microphone that he has a question.
Yes, indeed.
Or a statement. Mr. Chair, I mean, one of the things that the bill, the Dash amendments have is that it's discretionary. So they're going to be able to use the discretion that they feel is necessary. I think what we're trying to capture here is in a residential community or area, where you have a neighborhood grocery store or something in that line as compared to something maybe downtown Portland. Mm-hmm. And it seems to me that maybe leaving the person in there does, in fact, will provide for greater notification at the discretion of the entity that's going to be doing the notices.
I understand your point, Representative. I think Representative Ackerman's point is that as it's written with the words a person right now, assuming that it's adopted, it may require or notification to, you know, if you've got a house with everybody, you know, does it require that every person in the house receive a copy of the notification, or just, you know, one person in the house receives a copy of the notification? I think that's an issue that, you know, if we leave it unaddressed, it's going to end up having to get readdressed at some other point. What's your take, Representative Dingfelder?
Well, I'd be happy to work with the committee staff or legislative council to find a term. I would prefer not to narrow it so much, that because this isn't a prescriptive bill. This is permissive, and so I'd like to leave some flexibility. However, if it's limited to a person, then I do have concerns to make sure that the proper person gets notified, but I would leave that up to your discretion.
And I agree that it's permissive to the extent that a city can make a determination about whether they want to give the notice. But if we leave the words a person in the statute, they're going to be bound by the definition of a person as the statute describes it. So they won't have any permissiveness to once then decide who they're going to get the notice to. And if they attempt to adopt a rule to do that, they're likely going to run afoul of the statute and could potentially be challenged. Or if they adopt a rule that goes narrower and the statute says broader and someone wants to raise an issue because something's happened because they didn't get notification, there's just a whole legal issue there that I think we're stepping into without having it more clearly defined. Representative Ackerman, then yes, Representative Shetterly is noting something.
On my point, it may be better just to consider every household, since you could more easily obtain information regarding households from property tax rolls within 300 feet, rather than try to, you know, get hung up in every person, any person, or what that may be, assuming that would be sufficient. I think we're trying to look for a workable solution. I just throw that out.
I appreciate, Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, I appreciate that. I don't know if we could, instead of a person who resides, have a residence within 300 feet or a residence within, I mean, that leaves it broad. I don't know if you have to have a person. You're being the legal expert minds here. I will defer to you. But and that's something I'd be happy to work out.
We try not to make it up as we go along, though. That's, we usually get ourselves into more trouble that way. Here's what I would recommend. I think it does make some sense to try to address that issue because I think it needs to be addressed. I think our comfort level would be that it get addressed here as opposed to waiting until it gets over to the Senate. Representative Shetterly still has a comment, and Representative Anderson. So.
Yeah, I guess my only question is whether we need to amend 93-275 in this. If I'm looking at the Dash 1 amendments, you've got a determination that the property has been determined to be an illegal drug manufacturing site. I mean, that's a predicate for the notice. And 93-275, sub 1, paragraph B already has in it the consideration that the property was the site of a crime. It seems to me if the predicate finding is that there was illegal drug activity, I don't know that we need to expand 93-275 just to say it again.
If I may, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, Representative Shetterly, this clarification, as I say, stated previously, was at the request of the realtors. In the seller's property disclosure and disclaimer statements, and I'll be circling back here.
Okay.
Under a disclaimer, you have to tell about any problems with the property that is being sold. One of the requirements, and I'm quoting from you from one of the questions: are you aware of any government study, survey, or notices that would affect the property? That is the question, and you have to either check yes or no. Now, we understand that means the property being sold, but the concern among the realtors, as I understand it, is that somebody might make a claim that this does somehow affect the property, and as a result, that should have been disclosed because you did receive a government notice about something contaminated in your neighborhood. They're just concerned about smart attorneys, shall I say. I would agree with you that it's probably covered, but again, we were trying to get the comfort level with the realtors to the point that they wouldn't be jumping up and down screaming and hollering. We were trying to do this very nicely.
Well, at least it's not paranormal.
Yeah, right. You can come up and talk to us about paranormal activity like we did last session, but we'll just keep this out of the bill, Harlan. Okay, that's Representative Anderson.
You don't recognize me anymore.
Well, you've been gone. I was going to make a special point. We need a representative. Welcome Representative Anderson back from the dead. Lazarus, in fact, does live. We're glad to have you back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You've been traveling to China lately.
Thank you. I guess my question would be along the lines of, or statement would be along the lines of Representative Ackerman, that when you say shall give notice to a person, that brings up the question, do you give it to the 2-year-olds? Do you give it to the 90-year-olds? Are you giving it to everybody in the house? I really think the idea of each residence or workplace makes sense.
Chair Williams and Representative Anderson, I believe that was our intent from the beginning, frankly, and it's just something that my dull eyes just didn't simply catch.
I want to note it was his dull eyes, not mine, also.
Okay. So what I'm going to ask you to do then is work with legislative counsel and committee staff, see if you can come up with an amendment that satisfies, I think, the concerns that the committee's expressed about the Dash 1 amendments. And on Representative Shetterly's point, while I agree that I think it's probably subsumed in the language there, if buying some additional comfort by specifically referencing this notice is not something you have to disclose, satisfies the realtors on that issue, then I'm inclined to leave it in. Do you have any objection to that, Representative Shetterly?
No.
Okay. All right. Okay. Anyone else here? Thank you all very much. Appreciate your
you.
Time, Representative Chair,
and thank you, members of the committee.
Anyone else here to testify on House Bill 2594? Oh, sorry. Help if I had the right sheet. What happened to my sign-in sheet? Because if you were here to testify in 2594, you were too late. You can still testify on 3259, however, if you're here to testify on that. All right. Hearing none, then we're going to close the public hearing, and we'll see this back at work session. We'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3317 and invite Mr. Martinez to come forward.
Just here.
No.
It's possible.
Yep.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, it's always a little disconcerting when you approach the podium and the chair leaves, especially when you have about 30 seconds worth of testimony, but I will try to drag this on as long as I can. 3317 is a piece of the Oregon Bankers Association identity theft package. You'll see one bill after this one, and then actually one more, I think, later as the session progresses. It's part of a, as I say, part of a package that we spent the interim working on to try to get a handle on identity theft crime in Oregon. You've probably heard this before, but I'd run through it very quickly. Oregon now ranks 7th among the states in identifying crime per capita. That comes from the FTC. Financial fraud crimes are increasing at an alarming rate. In fact, the banking industry has experienced about a 17% increase in financial fraud for the last 7 years, and that's every year 17%. Those of you who remember Brady Adams, I know Representative Anderson does fondly. He was telling me the other day that, obviously banks and financial institutions keep a loan loss reserve. His reserve for financial fraud is actually larger than his loan loss reserve today, and we find that very typical in community banks. In fact, it's the hometown community banks with less than $500 million that are being hit the hardest because the large institutions have a lot of sophisticated fraud procedures in place. Turning very quickly to 3317, right now it is a crime in Oregon to go and use, have your credit card used for something other than what you requested. So, for example, if I went to a restaurant and had a $100 bill, they went ahead and ran my card for a $100 bill, but the wait person went ahead and did another $100 for themselves. That's a crime under Oregon law, and it's a Class C felony. What this bill does is add debit cards that are used in the same way to the Class C felony, and the new technology that the criminals have in this area is what's called a scanner. So when they go and try to run your card, they pull out this little machine, swipe it into the machine that downloads all the information on the magnetic strip, which then is uploaded into a computer and sold on the internet, and somebody has a free credit card. Well, relatively free. The only change we would make, as I say, it is be Class C felony. If there is more than one conviction, we would bump it up to a Class B felony. There's just something wrong, in our opinion, when the average bank robber who escapes with about $3,500 serves a 3 to 5 year sentence, and the average financial fraud or identity theft is about $17,000 and only receives probation and a small fine. I'd be happy to answer any questions now that the chairman is back.
You talked until I came back in. That's good. Well, obviously, to talk about usually the bank robber is threatening some sort of bodily harm. I mean, that's one of the reasons, whether he's got a gun or he says he's got a gun or a bomb. And then secondly, I guess, our concern and that this committee has routinely expressed, and you may not be able to give us much help here, is any increases in penalty levels comes usually at a cost. And while, generally we're all typically quite supportive of the concept, we've got about a $200 million hole in our public safety budget as it stands now. And, I'm not even able to, and we're not even able to really proceed with a lot of crimes that traditionally we have been proceeding with based on the Chief Justice's order, our inability to appoint counsel, and the like. So we're being very careful in weighing upgrades to crimes because of our concern that it looks good on paper, but the reality is we're not really able to implement it. Or if it takes resources away from somewhere else, that's a balancing test that this committee is obligated to do. And I don't know whether you've given much in the way of thought to those issues at all, and you have anything you want to say.
Mr. Chairman, I would. Thank you. I'd say two things. One, it's my understanding that the Revenue Office or the Fiscal Office said no impact on both this and the next bill. Secondly, though, as I indicated at the beginning of my testimony, the state of Washington is looking at almost the same set of bills that you'll have before you here. And those bills are moving through the process and are expected to be signed into law. They obviously have a budget situation as well. Our concern here in Oregon is that if they pass these laws in Washington and we don't have similar laws on the books down here, that it's very easy to move from Oregon to Washington and vice versa. We see this more as a deterrent, so they just drive on through, maybe buy some of our gas and keep going to another state.
Yeah. And I do find it unique. I just checked with counsel, and again, we don't have any feedback one way or the other from the fiscal office on these bills. It seems interesting to me that almost everybody else comes to testify, and this committee knows more about the status of the fiscal nature of these bills than the committee does. It's a difficult management issue, obviously, for us to have to deal with as we consider these bills. But Tim, your sense is you've gotten feedback from LFO that there are no fiscals associated with either 3317 or 3318.
Mr. Chairman, feedback comes from Patsy. She went online and checked and said there was no fiscal impact.
Okay. All right.
So, Mr. Chair?
Representative Shadow.
Well, in this case, I would imagine, in particular, since we're only increasing the second conviction or more, so it's not a across-the-board increase in the level of severity of this. So we're just, and it's already a felony, so we're just going from one level of felony to another for a second. So I'd have expected maybe more of an impact on the next one, but maybe that's because Class Cs can still be prosecuted as Class A misdemeanors. I don't know.
I don't know either.
On this one in particular, I wouldn't be surprised that there's not a fiscal.
All right. Any other questions? Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Tim, the idea of bodily harm was brought up. Could you relate the severity or the the relationship to identity theft and the harm that occurs there.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Anderson, that's a very good point. Obviously, you know, there is the threat of violence in a bank robbery, and very rare occasions that actually takes place. Clearly, that's, you know, against somebody that works for that financial institution and perhaps other folks that happen to be in that branch at that time. Identity theft, I think I know the direction you're going here. Identity theft does cause a lot of personal damage, both emotional as well as financial, to the person that has had their identity stolen. It also takes a long time, sometimes exceeding, you know, a couple of years to actually get everything straightened out on your financial side of the world. So, you know, I understand what the chairman's saying. It's just that when you look at what these losses are for identity theft, I think it's reasonable to have similar punishments.
Further questions? All right. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Mr.
Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 3317? Okay, we'll close the public hearing. We'll open a work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Brzezinski.
Move House Bill 3317 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Brzezinski moves House Bill 3317 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, and call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Cummell?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Kozlowski?
Aye.
Representative Chatterley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 3317 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer carrier? All right. Representative Brzezinski. Open a public hearing now on House Bill 3318 and call back up Mr. Martinez. And why don't we go ahead and have Kelly Skye come up too from OCDLA. Okay.
Yay.
I'll cross you off the list, Kelly. That never hurts this committee's feelings. So you're all welcome to withdraw your testimony at any time. Tim?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, again, Tim Martinez, Oregon Bankers Association, here on House Bill 3318. I can be shorter because the chair is still in his chair. This simply, I understand the comments from the prior bill, changes from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony, the unlawful production of driver's license, identity cards, et cetera, that ODOT provides. Again, we're seeing a huge increase in this type of activity and want to expand the slap on the hand. I did have the opportunity to meet with the representative from the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I pledged to work with her in the Senate if need be, if there were actual language that needed to be changed. She is very concerned that we're getting at, I have a 10-year-old, but when my 10-year-old gets 19, that he gets a fake license and goes in and buys a beer somewhere, that this crime would then apply to him. There is other section of the statute that does address this issue for when you're using an identity card for proof of age, which is not what we're after in this particular law. So I will work with her. I'm convinced that if there is a need for amendments, we will be able to do that, and would ask that this bill, given the lateness of the session, at least according to leadership, be moved along the process.
Questions for Mr. Martinez about this bill? Representative Brzezinski.
Mr. Chair, Tim, you and I have talked briefly about this. The one thing I would just, as a caution, if we move this up to a Class C felony, not knowing where it's going to fall on the felony sentencing guidelines, it's very possible those individuals are going to have presumptive probation as well as compared to if they were still a Class A misdemeanor. The courts could, in fact, sentence them to jail time as compared to not having access to the prison time, because it is where they're going to fall on the sentencing guidelines, just for your information as you're going through it.
Mr.
Chair and Mr. Krasowski. Thank you.
Any other questions? Tim, my concern about this one is, we checked with Patsy, and what the feedback that's on the computer right now, they haven't issued a fiscal impact. It simply says may have fiscal impact, but no statement yet issued. And so my concern on this one is that because we are shifting it from an A misdemeanor to a C felony, that there is going to be some fiscal impact associated with that. It doesn't mean that we ought not maybe do it. But in weighing that policy choice, I feel like the committee needs to know what that number is before we simply move the bill along. And we've been in the habit here lately of sort of moving some of these bills along quickly, not having the fiscal impact statement, only later having to pull the bill back and then send it to the Ways and Means Committee. So my preference is, and I know that there's some folks down at LFO who monitor this committee, that we simply wait a day or two until they've gotten the fiscal impact statement in our hands. We'll put the bill back up for a work session. That gives you a chance to actually work with Ms. Skye potentially on some of those amendments here rather than waiting until the Senate, and then we'll be in a better position to address the bill. Any objection to that?
None, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. All right. Good. Thank you. All right. Then we'll close the hearing on House Bill 3318. We'll open a hearing on House Bill 3361. And call up Mr. Frisch, Barney Spate, and Bruce Bishop. Mr. Frisch.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Frisch, and I'm the in-house counsel to the Oregon Medical Association. And on behalf of the association, I offer the following comments in support of House Bill 3361, the so-called doctor apology bill. Section 1 of the bill, subsection 1, under it, an expression of regret or apology by a licensee of the Board of Medical Examiners is not an admission of liability for any purpose. Subsection 2 of Section 1 prohibits a licensee who makes an expression of regret or apology from being examined with respect to that expression in any civil or administrative proceeding, by deposition or otherwise. In Section 2, Subsection 1, it applies the prohibitions of Subsection 1 to expressions made on or after the effective date of the Act. And Subsection 2 of Section 2 makes the Act inapplicable to civil actions in which either a judgment order or an administrative proceeding final order were entered before the Act's effective date. From our association's perspective, the bill could not be any more important and the policy behind it more clear. Patients and patients' families and caregivers, be they doctors, nurses, or anyone else, have a fundamental need to communicate when unexpected bad outcomes occur. However, without House Bill 3361, a physician's statement to the effect that I'm sorry this has happened to you, which is just an expression of concern and compassion, could be misconstrued and ultimately used as an admission of liability. As a matter of good public policy, we should not inhibit a humane gesture. In fact, numerous studies show that everyone involved wants and needs actions that spontaneously convey a sense of compassion or commiseration. This is similar to legislation that's been enacted in the state of Washington, state of California, Massachusetts, Texas, Florida, and Tennessee. And in the commentary to the Tennessee evidence rule, the folks there say that it is consistent with their state's policy to focus on mediation and other methods of dispute resolution that seek to avoid trial and facilitate a resolution acceptable to all parties. And I think that's also consistent with our policy, particularly in this era of constrained budgets and difficulty with our courts. House Bill 3361 would not foreclose any of the rights currently held by a patient, and an admission of negligence, a statement such as "I made a mistake," would still be admissible. It's only the expression of regret or apology for which our association's members are seeking protection. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Frisch. Mr. Spate?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Barney Spate with Kaiser Foundation Health Plan, and also appearing today on behalf of Northwest Permanente Physicians and Surgeons, PC. We support 3361 in our organization. Over the last few years, we've spent a great deal of time in the area of, and money and training in the area of patient safety, both to develop a blame-free culture, to early identify systems weaknesses, but also to train and coach healthcare providers and physicians on better communication techniques with patients. We think this bill helps in that regard and is consistent with much of the other patient safety work that's already being done and is being considered in other bills before the legislature. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Mr. Bishop.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, for the record, I'm Bruce Bishop. I'm appearing on behalf of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems in support of House Bill 3361. We think that this bill is an important policy statement that encourages a climate of collaboration among physicians and will address the improvement of medical care in the state. We are somewhat sorry that the bill was drafted as narrowly as it is, but still we think it's a good idea, and we would urge the committee's support of the legislation.
All right. Are there questions for the panel? Representative McPherson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As a lawyer who advises several medical groups, the problem that's addressed in this bill is one that has always seemed to me particularly troublesome, which is that the discipline that I come from, it causes me to advise my clients not to say anything at times when the circumstances call out for some statement. And so I think this is a very positive step toward improving the communication flow that occurs when there are bad outcomes, regardless of, you know, what may have caused those outcomes. My question, and I'll put it to any of the panel who wants to respond, is do you envision there being sort of a program of re-education for physicians who have been listening to people from my profession maybe for too long about hunkering down and not saying anything, or do you think is it all part of the natural improvement in patient-physician communication that I think has been occurring in recent years?
Mr. Chair, Representative McPherson, my job at the association for the past 19 years has been to do education of physicians and their office personnel. And an important part of the work that we've been doing to lay the groundwork for this whole concept of patient safety has been to express our desire that if the climate is right legally, that we would want to proceed in this way. And we have worked diligently over the last 3 years educating some 3,000 plus doctors that should this bill be signed and become law, we will be in a position to do the things that they want to do. Their desire, they tell us in the workshops, is they want to do it. They understand that if the climate is right, they can, and they're looking forward to the possibility of being able to.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative McPherson. Further questions? Anybody? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else here to testify on House Bill 3361? All right, we'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3361. We'll open a work session on House Bill 3361.
Mr. Chair.
Representative McPherson.
I move that House Bill 3361 go to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative McPherson moves House Bill 3361 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion on his motion?
Good bill.
What all right.
Do? Should pass it.
Hearing none and call for roll.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
Aye.
Representative Kummel?
Aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Kuzanski?
Aye.
Representative Shelley?
Aye.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Ackerman?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. House Bill 3361 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I see two people who want to carry this bill.
Should we arm wrestle it?
Oh, if you want to, go ahead.
I would like to, because it touches on an issue that I have encountered and practiced before.
Then Representative McPherson, you should carry the bill, but Representative Anderson, given your experience having to deal with people in these situations and having to apologize, I wasn't going to say that. I would welcome you to speak to the bill. So Representative McPherson will carry. Finally, House Bill 3366. Open a public hearing and ask Mr. Rasmussen from come forward. One of our bankers, is that right?
That's right.
You're not going to bring Ken up with you on this one?
I don't know if Ken wants to come.
Well, I just always wonder why, you know, I mean, the association's paying him to be in the room. Why they wouldn't make him come sit up at the table and at least try to get something for their money?
Shamed him into
it. Go ahead.
You can harass me as well in the back of the room as you can up here.
Yeah, that's right. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dick Rasmussen. I'm the general counsel of West Coast Bancorp, which is headquartered in the state of Oregon, has about 35 branches here. I'm here to testify in favor of House Bill 3366. I'll keep my testimony brief, and we'll be glad to respond to any questions the committee may have. As you're all aware, the primary purpose of the bill is to limit the enforceability of oral commitments to lend money. Current law requiring that commitments to lend be in writing is found in ORS 41581H. That paragraph was enacted in 1989. The problem with current law is that it's completely ineffective to achieve its purpose. West Coast Bank has been sued 3 times in the last 2 years based on allegations that it breached oral commitments to lend. After investigation in each case, we determined that those allegations were meritless. However, in each case, we also did not raise 41580 as a defense because we believed that doing so would have been a waste of time and money. We view the current law as ineffective because it recognizes that all exceptions to the statutes of fraud, which are found in ORS or recognized by the courts of the state. The laundry list of exceptions includes such easy to allege legal theories as reliance and estoppel and so forth. In essence, in our view, the exceptions have swallowed the rule. The most significant provision of the bill is the modification of 41582A. Instead of recognizing all exceptions to the statutes found in ORS or recognized by the courts, the only recognized exceptions will be in court admissions. If the bill is adopted, Oregon law regarding the enforceability of oral commitments to lend will be very similar to Washington law. I'd be glad to respond to any questions the committee may have.
There are questions by committee members? Can you give us a couple of the examples of situations where this has been raised and where you felt like the statute wasn't, in fact, going to give you any assistance?
Well, in each of the cases where litigation was brought against us, it was clear to us that the plaintiff in the case would allege that the plaintiff had relied on the oral statement of that was allegedly made by the loan officer, and it was so easy to do that we didn't feel there'd be any value in raising the statute as a defense. That was the situation with all 3 cases.
Okay. Other questions? Representative Frommel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm a little bit perplexed. This seems like kind of a common sense sort of a thing. I bought a house last year and knew that until I received documents from the in the form of a letter from the loan officer that my mortgage was in fact approved. Irrespective of what he might have told me over the phone verbally, it wasn't a deal until it was a deal. I guess I'm perplexed as to how anybody, and especially in a commercial setting, could think that they, you know, have a guarantee of a loan without documentation to back it up.
Well, that's our view of the way we feel the law should be.
And this will clarify it then.
This will clarify it, absolutely.
Thank you.
Yes, Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm a little unclear still. Does this relate to those transactions where they're done over the phone and there's no signature involved?
Yes, that's
the only situation.
Well, it could be, the statute deals with oral commitments to lend, whether it's over the phone, face-to-face, that type of commitment.
But not just credit card problems.
Yes,
it could relate to a mortgage, or it could relate to...
Well, the statute, in essence, really only applies to commitments to lend for business or commercial purposes. It does not affect commitments for personal, family, household purposes.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
That's what I wanted to clarify. It's one of these statutes that kind of got two or three levels down. You've got the statute of frauds that says that an agreement's void unless it's in writing, and then you get down to 1H, and that says an agreement, promise, or commitment to lend money, but then it says, but this paragraph doesn't apply to, and then basically private party agreements, and then B being a loan of money or extension of credit to a natural person, primarily for personal, family, or household purposes. We're not changing that, the statute of frauds. Let's see.
It does or doesn't it?
Still
does not.
Does not apply to,
to commitments for personal, family, household purposes. That is correct. That,
right.
That piece of the current statute is not affected.
Right.
And then, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If I could, if they could walk me through 2A and what that does, there's a lot of
ins and outs there.
Deleted and new language there to help me understand exactly what we're doing there.
Okay.
This is lines 9 through 11 on
page 2.
2A is the sort of the key part of the bill, in my view, and what it does is instead of permitting as exceptions any exception to the statute of frauds, which is found anywhere in ORS or has been recognized by the courts, it will only permit exceptions that are stated in sub 2. And the only exception stated in sub 2 is admissions, either in a pleading or in testimony in court.
Okay. Does that satisfy your question, Representative Shetterly?
I think so. I'm getting there.
Any other questions? All right. Thank you, gentlemen. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 3366. I want to make sure.
Go ahead and we'll see if we have a discussion.
Okay, we're going to open a work session, and I just see people reading through the detailed language of the bill, and we were ahead of schedule on the agenda today, colleagues. So I don't mind taking a minute to make sure that we're comfortable with what this bill is doing. I don't want you to feel like you've been Mack trucked here. And if we need to bring those gentlemen back up to sort of make it very, very clear, we can do that.
I think this is a part of the commercial law class I missed.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Let's kind of walk through that.
Yeah.
Except as provided in this subsection, because that's just wordsmithing there.
Right.
Defenses and exceptions created by provisions of the ORS or recognized by the courts of this state do not apply
to subsection
1H
of this section,
which is the promise to lend, but that of course includes then the exception for
so those things don't apply to an agreement, promise, or commitment to lend money, to otherwise extend credit, to forbear with respect to repayment of any debt in money, to modify or amend the terms under which a person has lent money or otherwise extended credit, to release any guarantor or cosigner, or to make any other financial accommodation pertaining to an existing debt or other extension of credit.
Okay, so then I guess maybe if we say it one more time, we'll get it, if I may. So in the case of 1H transactions, agreement, promise, or commitment to lend money, etc., the only exception will be those in 2B, and that's where we talk about either an admission or testimonial...
In court.
Yeah, in court. Okay. So... Okay.
Seems like there'd be an easier way to say it.
Okay, we're going to try a little experiment here. And we want to welcome back Dick Rasmussen. Now, Dick, do you have kids?
Yes, I have two kids.
How old are your kids?
22 and
24. Oh, no fair.
No, that's all right. All right. Representative Shetterly, how old is your oldest?
10 and 12.
10 and 12, all right. All right, Dick, pretend like you're having to explain this bill to Representative Shetterly's 10 and 12-year-old. What does this bill do?
Well, what this bill does is tell my kid who wants to open a lemonade stand and go into the business of selling lemonade that if he goes down to the bank and asks for a loan to open his lemonade stand, that when the banker says, you've got that loan, that he can't rely on that until the banker sends him a letter that spells out in writing that he's got the loan.
With the exception if he's in court and he says that, yeah, he's on the hook.
That's right. Unless he's in court and the banker admits
right.
That he promised to make the loan.
Right.
Or if, instead of a lemonade stand, he's buying a home.
Right, something that was non-commercial, non-commercial transaction.
Yeah, I opened a lemonade stand to make it clear it was for business purposes. Mm-hmm.
But if he had gotten a loan to build his treehouse, that's probably something for personal, family, or household purposes and not for business or agricultural purposes. And therefore, he could rely on the statement that he'd got the loan.
And he could sue the bank when the bank failed to make the loan as promised.
Right.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Sherrill?
Well, I think I understand that. I guess my question is, are we doing anything with regard to defenses and exceptions that are currently applicable to 1A to G?
They're all being thrown out, in essence. The ones that we've had trouble with that you'll find in either A through G or in case law, I'm not sure which, reliance, estoppel, partial performance are probably the primary ones that are being eliminated in the context of a commitment to land.
Oh, Mr. In a commitment to land, but not in relation to any of the other... Not in the commitment.
A through G are not otherwise affected.
Yeah. Right.
That's right.
Right. Okay, is that helpful? People feel like they got a little more idea about what this bill actually does?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Chamberlain.
Well, I'm just curious then. It's been a long time since I've used the statute of frauds, but estoppel is one. What other are some of the general exceptions to... of course, we've got admission. That's already covered in 2A. That's
reliance and partial performance are the primary statute of frauds defenses.
Okay.
Representative Anderson,
thank you,
you want to pull your mic up?
Thank you. So, essentially, if he goes to the banker and the banker says you got the loan, but he doesn't have a signature on it, that's the key. Is that right?
Has to be in writing. Yes, that's the key. This will require that the commitment to land be in writing.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Ackerman?
Well, if we waive these defenses, what's the rationale for doing that other than you know, you want to win? But these are doctrines.
The statutes of regarding oral commitments to land have been adopted in, according to the latest information I have, 33 or 34 states. And I think the primary reason that they get adopted is that banks are just, and other financial institutions without this kind of protection are just too easy to hit as targets. We've had I spoke briefly earlier about the three cases we've had in the last 2 years. We've settled two of them, and it, And notwithstanding the fact that we believed that we'd done nothing wrong, we had to pay up. And the third case is still pending.
It is tremendously easy, in my own experience, occasionally having represented financial institutions, when a business is in the throes of having some very significant problems, and when they have been at times perhaps even less than honest about their financial position with their own lender, to after things have sort of hit the fan and everybody's after them, to zero in on some particular account relationships person and say, but he kept telling me that we were going to get this loan. And even despite the fact that no documentation in the file would necessarily suggest that, it creates a substantial liability for the institution in order to have to address it. And so I'm assuming that this is coming from that very sort of a challenge of you've got a person who's in the throes of a pretty bad situation for their business and now want to sort of put the responsibility on a lending institution when there's nothing in writing and only one word against the other about whether the person said they would or they wouldn't get the loan. And this simply says that you don't get to rely on that unless it's in writing. And so if the person says you get the loan, you turn to them and you say, good, put it on a piece of paper and I can rely on it.
But don't banks typically cover themselves with what we call a private statute of frauds? I mean, isn't that language in any kind of loan application or document that you would normally have submitted?
That assumes, sometimes yes, but that assumes that the prospective borrower has already come in and signed some loan documents. Often these cases arise when there are no written agreements between the prospective borrower and the financial institution.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. We are in work session.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Crummell.
I'll move House Bill 3366 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Crummell moves House Bill 3366 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Representative Shadow.
I see that we are deleting language. Obviously, it has expired by its time, but that did require banks to develop a program to, at a minimum, include making available to existing and potential commercial borrowers on a continuing basis a brochure or other written materials. Is that kind of a program still in play?
That was adopted when the bill was passed in 89,
yeah.
Three-year program.
Okay. Okay.
Discussion. Representative Brzezinski.
Well, my hesitation, and this is not an area of law that I practice, but when we pretty well are saying we're going to limit or prohibit all defenses, I'm thinking in the sense of if you have someone that goes in, talks to a lender for a business, and the person says, yeah, we're going to get that loan to you, and if it continues to hear that same statement, and the individual begins to rely on that statement without the paperwork being done, are we somehow putting them in a more of a disadvantage than what they should be by not being able to at least claim that they relied on that lender's verbal oral statements that they're going to get it, and they may not be as savvy as saying, yeah, we'll put it on a piece of paper and I know I can count on it. I don't know. I just, this is an area that's...
Well, first off, in recognizing that not every business transaction is a major business transaction, so it could be a small business where there isn't someone terribly sophisticated. But we are talking about a business relationship, and there are things in the law with respect, for example, a real estate transaction, where we have consistently said that it doesn't matter what somebody says; it matters what's on the piece of paper. And I think all we're doing with this is essentially expanding sort of that doctrine to commercial lending relationships to say that you can't, you can't come in and say that a lender, at the bank said you were going to get money unless you have gotten that commitment in writing. And in some ways, I think that's as much a protection for the person
in the long run as it is for the bank, because they know that they can't rely on a statement until they have a written commitment, and that ought to then be the thing that directs their actions, that they don't go out and buy a whole bunch of materials based on some promise that they're going to get a loan until they've actually got the loan commitment sitting in front of them. And there's value in balancing that transactional relationship, it seems to me, for both parties over time. In the short run, as this is new and implemented and some people aren't experienced with it, therein may be an issue. But I think by and large that in the long run, this gives a definition to both sides of the transaction, knowing what they have to do, and removes a very expensive sort of litigation element out of these kinds of business relationships. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It strikes me that one of the things we're doing here is presupposing that the only thing that's happening is between the loaning institution and the borrower. Doesn't perhaps take consideration other interactions that may be taking place between the potential borrower and some type of business partnerships or business arrangements that would maybe be necessary with other people. Not all business transactions, or not all businesses are so simple as to just be between the two entities, I understand a little bit the idea of have it in writing, dummy, sort of concept, but I also have some problem with somewhere there needs to be some type of trust, albeit an unwritten contract, if you wish, between individuals that has some meaning. Otherwise, it has no meaning when I go into a banker and he says, I'm willing to loan you money for this business transaction. And you go out and do some other things predicated upon that conversation. And then you come back and run into this written agreement. And I'm also wondering, Mr. Chairman, if you just want to put it in writing, why we need to kind of do all this doublespeak to get it in writing, why we just don't say it straightforward.
I think that's as much a historical accident of how the statutes have been written probably over the last 100 years, Representative, as anything else, but I see your point. Other comments?
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative.
It just seems to me that it makes a lot of sense. I can't, first of all, believe that there wouldn't be a bank, that there are still banks out there that would not put loan commitments in writing. And maybe it's just because of my experiences and that sort of thing, but I can't believe that somebody would actually go ahead and make other commitments as far as if they were starting a business or carrying on a business and they needed some kind of financial backing, whether that was from a bank or from investors or whomever. I can't believe that they wouldn't wait until it was all in writing and they knew that everybody was in agreement before they went ahead and moved forward. So I guess I'm having a hard time believing that somebody is actually goofy enough to go out there and do other transactions based on a verbal commitment without having something to back it up with. But if this is what we need to do, then I certainly have no problem voting in favor of the bill to make sure that people understand that if you're going to borrow money from somebody, you need to put it in writing.
Okay. No more handshake agreements.
You have a written notice, you have to have the oral. Or
handshake agreements went out the window in a lot of cases years ago.
Well, I'm trying to get a sense of where we're at this point. Representative Shetterly?
To respond to Representative Krummel, I can see the situations where loss could occur here, not because somebody goes out and actually incurs some expense, but maybe elects not to pursue other financing options or elects not to pursue other opportunities based on
some assurance that they've received that the loan's forthcoming, and so because of that, when they don't get the other loan, maybe timing opportunities have passed. So now, not having gone out and incurred any liabilities, but having foregone opportunities to pursue some other financing, they've lost the whole shooting match. I mean, I can see that causing a loss, as well as, you know, something that would be blatantly foolish to go out and, you know, put a down payment on a you know, shopping mall or something on the strength of an oral representation. But I can see some people forbearing on the word of the small town banker or something who maybe doesn't control the loan decision entirely, and all of a sudden has to say, "Oops, I got the rug pulled out from under me by, I don't know, Minneapolis or wherever the decision may actually be made."
As a result of
Representative,
which probably has been a significant reason in the growth in community banking.
Right, and West Coast is a good community bank. I mean, not to.
But I have to go to Portland or someplace for an okay guy.
Yeah. See, and for those of us in Portland, we're just happy when you got to go to Portland and not to Minneapolis. So
that's as easy for me to go to Minneapolis as it is Portland.
Well, let's see. Representative Crummell has made the motion, and is there any further discussion on this motion? Seeing none, and let's call the roll.
Representative
Barclay?
Aye.
Representative Jensen?
I don't know.
You heard an I and a no.
Yeah, there was an I and a don't know in there. You got to pick one of them, Bob.
Yeah, maybe I better do no, just in case somebody would pick on me to want me to carry it.
Okay, so there's a yes and a no.
I'm the one at risk here.
Yeah, right.
Keep going, Ann. I'm counting. Who?
That was a no. Right?
That was a no, I think, yeah.
Representative Crummell?
An enthusiastic aye.
Representative McPherson?
Aye.
Representative Pazowski?
Lukewarm aye.
Representative Shadowy?
Same as Brzezinski.
Vice Chair Anderson?
Does a no mean I don't have to carry it?
Well, yeah, it certainly means you don't have to carry it. Okay, that's
soft eye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Okay.
Put it in writing.
Yeah.
Put it in writing.
House Bill 3366 passes with fascinating discussion. Representative Crummell, with his enthusiastic eye, will carry the bill, and I really do appreciate the committee's gradation of their votes in matters such as this. And I would encourage Mr. Martinez, to those of you who were lukewarm, circle back and have a conversation with you. With that committee, we are adjourned for the afternoon.
We'll line wait.